You are listening to Fanthatrax.
Because of the following special program, Wonder Woman and the Incredible Hulk will not be presented this evening.
Time to get all your Star Wars news in a single file. This is Making Tracks. Here are your hosts, Mark Newbold and Mark Mulcaster.
That's not true. That's impossible.
You're listening to Making Tracks. This is episode 123. I'm your co-host, Mark Newbold, and joining me today is a man who likes digging up news like massives like digging up black melons. It's Mark Mulcaster. Mark, how are you doing?
I love black melons. The bigger, the better.
I knew you were going to say that. It's the best moisture in the galaxy.
Absolutely.
Let's be honest.
It's what keeps you alive on the desert sands of Tatooine.
How's your week been?
Week's been good, dude. It's been a week of two halves, which I think is quite apt considering the episode of Book of Boba Fett we've just had. You know, so I had a quite earlier start to the week in terms of work, and then it got busy at the back end. And, you know, I was thinking on Wednesday, I haven't actually received anything to talk about in terms of, like, new Star Wars acquisitions. And again, I now have quite a bit, so yeah, that's all good. How about yourself?
Regular week. A few bits have come in, but I want to hear about your stuff. What stuff's come to you?
Probably a couple of things that you've received already. So I got my Goldsborough Books copy of Fallen Star, which has got the nice kind of yellow edged pages, and signed yes. by the delightful Claudia Gray, and that's going to go next to its regular edition copy. I had, and we can only blame the US Post Office for it, my Happy Holidays Rancho Obi-Wan Christmas card came yes. through, and this one is definitely down to Mr. Matt Booker because he posted a link in one of our group chats. I've got a lovely Death Star tablecloth set which came from Zavi. So he posted and I saw it and I looked down at the price.
Can you hear that? Can you hear that? I got one as well.
It's only $4.99, but when I say, actually, it's reduced from like $44.99 for that price, you think, why the hell not? Admittedly, I did try and sell it to Karen for £45 earlier on, but she wasn't having any of it.
Yeah, I was exactly the same. I got two because I thought it was too cool. So yeah. One of them, I've got a desk upstairs that's going to go on. So one's going upstairs. Also got the Goldsboro book. Also got my Rancho card.
Cool, yeah.
So quite similar there. A friend of mine, late Christmas present turned up. It was a Star Wars calendar.
Nice.
It was one that I hadn't got. And honestly, as soon as it turned up, I went, I know what that is. Mm. It's the Mandalorian calendar. But it wasn't. It was the villain's calendar, which Ooh. I hadn't got. So I was really chuffed with that. I hadn't got any ILM or really any crew stuff from Rise of Skywalker.
No.
Online in one of the sort of the collector groups, the cast and crew collector groups, I managed to get the ILM cap for the Rise of Skywalker.
Oh, nice.
Which is really cool. So it's got all the sort of ILM episode 9 stuff on the back.
Yeah.
And on the front, it's just Kylo Ren's TIE silencer.
Yeah.
So it really looks nice. Mm. It's really nice. So it's been a good week. Loads of news. We need to get into it because, as always, there's loads to talk through. But we will make one little announcement that we literally just decided before we started recording.
I know. Yeah, go on then.
Well, do you want to say it or shall I say it?
Well, I don't mind. I can say it, as this is pretty much live. So we had a quick chat just before the show, and as much as we really, really, really love doing our Sunday long kind of reviews of the Book of Boba Fett, we kind of realised that by the time that people get to listen to it on the Tuesday, it's probably a little bit late. So we're going to try for the remainder of the series anyway, and maybe going forward into Andor and Kenobi, we're going to try and do kind of these quick reactionary episodes which will come out the same night as the episode. If you get a chance to watch the episode on Wednesday morning, then you might be able to listen to us talk about it on Wednesday night. Or failing that, if you watch on Wednesday evening when you get back from work, you should be able to listen to it on Thursday morning to your commute. I mean, it'll be a bit rough and ready because, well, you know, it's me and Mark. So we figured it would just be kind of fun just to do a kind of a raw initial knee-jerk reaction reviews.
Wednesdays going forward, so from this Wednesday, so you're hearing this on Tuesday, believe it or not, you're getting another episode tomorrow, and it's going to be fresh out of the oven, not lovingly edited like these episodes are. And we're, of course, going to talk a little bit about the episode on a Sunday because it's what's happening in Star Wars right now. But certainly until the end of the season of Book of Boba Fett, you'll get a regular Making Tracks episode on a Tuesday. You'll get a nice rough and ready live, as live episode talking about today's episode of Book of Boba Fett. And that's what we're going to do. But today we are talking about the streets of Mos Espa, or as I called it on Twitter, the streets of Mos Vespa. We'll get to that in a little minute.
Hello, my name is Aidan Cook, and you're listening to Fanthatrax.
The author, Dave Wolverton, sadly passed away. In Star Wars circles, Dave would be best known for, I think it's fair to say, for The Courtship of Princess Leia, his 1994 book that was early in that sort of post-Heir to the Empire era. He also wrote a number of other Star Wars books. He wrote the short tale of Dengar called Payback in Tales from the Bounty Hunters. He did a couple of entries in the Jedi Apprentice series, a couple of entries in the Star Wars Adventures series in 2003, which was prequel based. As a legacy in Star Wars, that's quite a hefty thing to leave and very prescient at the moment, given a Rancor's just turned up in the Book of Boba Fett.
You're completely right. And for me personally, the courtship of Princess Leia has fairly kind of sentimental value because of the fact that that was the very first expanded universe book that I actually brought. All the books up to that point, so from Heir to the Empire onwards, I just got them out of the good old Yateley Library of all places. But this was the first hardcover that was my month's pocket money. To be fair, the cover has always been quite catching to me. I've always liked that cover. Yeah. You know, that book, as well as I think sometimes some of the other early expanded universe books kind of get slightly maligned because I think they're just in the shadow of the Empire trilogy, Timothy Zahn's first trilogy. It's actually a really pretty good book. And also, I think there's been such a long-lasting legacy that has actually followed on from what Dave wrote in some of those books, which have kind of carried over into canon. You know, you think of the Night Sisters and how important a part they played in the Clone Wars. And now, you know, we've got Boba Fett wanting to ride a Rancor, which is when they first did it. You know, the Night Sisters were riding around on the backs of Rancors on Dathomir for, you know, years. And Dave was the first person to write about that.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, it seems kind of sad and strange that that episode in particular would come out the day, literally the day that he passed away, the 14th. Yeah. Another great Star Wars author has gone. But he leaves great stories behind and all these things get taken forward. So his contributions to Star Wars certainly won't be forgotten. And again, as we say, he had that story in the Tales from Bounty Hunters as well about Dengar. We're sure Dengar's got his day in the sun coming up. So fingers crossed there'll be more of Dave's contributions that will be used there. But sad news, Dave Wolverton, author of Courtship of Princess Leia, has passed away, age 64.
Hi, this is George Mann and you're listening to Fantha Tracks.
So Kathleen Kennedy, she must have had some work done in her office because her shelves must be literally bulging and breaking at the seams with all the awards that she's picking up. And she's about to pick up another one. The 33rd Producers Guild Awards, which takes place on the 19th of March, will see Kathleen and George Lucas both receive the Milestone Award from the Producers Guild of America for their contributions to cinema. I mean, we could talk for a whole episode about the contributions that Lucas has made, of course, and that Kathleen Kennedy has made as a producer. And I think it's also interesting to point out that you think of Lucas as a writer-director, but his producing work as well, you think he was the executive producer on his original six Star Wars movies, if you want to frame it like that. Obviously, the Indiana Jones, the first four Indiana Jones movies. His producing credits are incredible as well. But obviously, it's well-deserved for both, isn't it?
Oh, absolutely, yeah. And I think my worry for Kathleen Kennedy, for rightly or wrongly opinions about the subsequent Disney-era sequel Star Wars films and everything that's come out since then, kind of overshadowed those amazing films that she produced before that. And I think a lot of people kind of almost forget all those films that she worked on before she joined Lucasfilm.
With very few exceptions, you name a classic film from the 80s and 90s and top tier box office movies or bit top end films with ILM visual effects and all the whistles and bells, not that many don't have her name attached to it. Jurassic, Back to the Future, Indiana Jones, the list of accomplishments and films that she's done just is, you could write them on a toilet roll and run out of paper. So just incredible contribution to cinema there. And I think it says a lot of people when they criticize her, almost as if she's riding on the coattails of Steven Spielberg, as if Steven Spielberg would keep somebody around that wasn't doing an excellent job. Do they think that little of Spielberg?
Yeah.
By making that comment, I don't think people think their logic through.
You know, to be fair, you've got to remember also that Kathleen Kennedy is a honorary member of Fanfotrax. So in some part, I kind of feel like Fanfotrax may have played a part in her receiving this award.
Oh, it makes me feel a lot better you saying that. I'm so glad you pointed that out. I think somewhere there's all these like Oscars and awards and stuff, and in the middle is a framed Fanfotrax shirt with a little spotlight shining on it.
Hey man, it's me, Kevin Smith, Star Wars fan, Fantatrax fan.
May the toys be with you. It's arriving in Litchfield in Staffordshire, not a million miles away from where I'm sitting right now. It's bringing loads of vintage Star Wars, all sorts of incredible stuff to the hub at St Mary's, which is right in the middle of the city. It's the exhibition that runs from the Saturday, the 22nd of January, right through to the 20th of March. It's a 30-minute tour. You only need tickets at the weekends. If anybody's been to any of the other May the Toys Be With You events around the UK, and they've been all over the place, they've been down south, they've been on the coast, they've been around so far, and fascinating stuff, well worth going. There's lots happening during the time that May the Toys Be With You is at the hub. There's a musical quartet called the Highly Strung Quartet. They're performing Starlight, the music of John Williams, at the hub That's on the 26th of February. It's a Saturday. Tickets are £18. It starts at 7:30. Fantatrax will be there because we're not going to miss something as cool as that. And then on the 17th of March, Richard Winterton Auctioneers are doing a special auction at the Hub, and the percentage of the money goes to the Hub because it's part of the church. So obviously they're constantly fundraising. Are you going to be coming up for this?
Yeah, absolutely. I will definitely come up at some point. The last time I saw, in fact, was at Maidstone, and the Rebel Legion and the UK Garrison were there, actually, and we actually had a fun time and photos amongst the exhibit, and we were outside the Maidstone Museum, and it well received, and I think actually we helped pull in a few more punters that day, which was great. I mean, it's an impressive collection, and it's got some really rare items, which, you know, stuff that hasn't been produced before, and items that I think a lot of people who go there kind of go, oh my God, I had that, or I didn't have that, but I wish I had that. And, you know, it's definitely worth a visit if you get a chance.
I'm very much looking forward to it. Got to go and do it. So if you're in the area, or even if you're not, take a visit to Litchfield. It's a beautiful city. It's a cathedral city. It's well worth visiting. Come and see May the Toys Be With You from the 22nd of January to the 20th of March at the Hub at St Mary's. And on Friday, this coming Friday, there's a press day, and I'm going to be talking to Matt Fox from May the Toys Be With You. So next episode of Making Tracks, there'll be a brief conversation between myself and Matt Fox talking all about May the Toys Be With You.
Hello, I'm Dennis Lawson, and you're listening to Fantha Tracks.
So for the final time in a regular Tuesday episode of Making Tracks, we're going to talk about an episode from season one of The Book of Boba Fett. This is chapter 3, The Streets of Mos Espa. It's an episode, I think it's fair to say, that has divided fandom. Lots of picking on small elements in the grand scheme of things, whilst not celebrating some of the awesomeness, and there's a lot of awesomeness in this episode. Speaking for myself, really enjoyed it, thought it was great fun. Totally different tonally to last week's episode, which I think was a highlight of all Star Wars. It really was a fantastic episode. This, very different, seemed to be more about moving the story forward and pushing on into current era, and I thought it was excellent, but I want to hear what you thought about this one, Mark.
First time I watched it, I was just like, it's all right. It wasn't anything special, and I happened to have watched it first thing on a Wednesday morning, and there wasn't actually that many people who had seen it, so I didn't really have anybody to kind of talk to about it, which is a bit annoying. But then I did rewatch it, and to be fair, it's not the worst, and, you know, considering a lot of the comments and a lot of the things that people are, like you said, nitpicking over, they are issues, but I don't necessarily think they're specific issues to that episode. I think there's issues that I think maybe are just inherent with the Book of Boba Fett series as a whole, and potentially also some aspects to the world of making Star Wars on a smaller TV budget.
That's an interesting point. I mean, whilst visually certain episodes look like you could just throw them on the big screen, maybe it's fair to say Book of Boba Fett feels tighter, smaller, more closed in, because it is all set on Tatooine, mostly on Mos Espa or the palace.
Yeah.
Or when, you know, you get out into the Dune Sea, I'm thinking back to that season 2, episode 1 of Mando the Marshal. It was so grand and sweeping and felt like it could be thrown up on a cinema screen. But there's no getting away from the fact that people make movies like movies and make TV shows like TV shows. It is a TV show, it's not a movie. Even though it looks like a movie, it's got all the whistles and bells that a movie would have these days. But nevertheless, there's something about Book of Boba Fett. It feels like they've tried to sort of dial in a little bit and make it more small scale, because my gut tells me that it's going to explode and you'll look back like the first couple of 3 episodes of WandaVision a year ago. We'd go, what the heck is this 1950s sitcom crap? You know, yeah. And then eventually we're like, it makes all the sense. And there's a big part of me thinking, got to be patient. Take the episode as it comes. We can only talk about what we've seen and hypothesise what's to come.
Yeah.
And then get proved wrong the following week, like we nearly 9 times out of 10 do. That's how it feels.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I think the one thing that I find quite interesting, and it seems to go against from what obviously we read a lot in the comics, especially like with War of the Bounty Hunters and stuff like that, isn't actually about Boba Fett, but it's about Jabba the Hutt's reach. Because it kind of seems like everything that we're doing at the moment, or we're seeing at the moment on the Book of Boba Fett, is very, very small. It's only focused on basically, you know, the closest town, or the, you know, the capital city on Tatooine. And if you were to ask most Star Wars fans, you know, who's Jabba the Hutt, they'd say he's this massive international or interstellar crime boss. You know, he's got quite a big reach. And that's not what we're seeing. Now, whether or not that's to do with the mismanagement of how Bib Fortuna's handled it, or maybe it's just some kind of misconception on our behalf, I find it quite interesting, because it, you know, we had that map with 88, and he's having to explain the interplay between the three different gangs, you know, the Trandoshans and the Aquilician. To me, anyway, before this series came out, I would just kind of go, well, that just seems like a little bit too trivial, you know, to even worry Jabba. But maybe that's a testament to how things have gone since that sail barge blew up. Where the division has come from is basically it comes down from the expectations of what we expect Boba Fett would do versus the acceptance of, you know, having somebody else come in and give us a different perspective. Because how easy would it have been for Favreau to pretty much have written Boba Fett kind of story that would have just leapt straight out of the comic books, where he was badass and he wasn't very verbose and all that. That's going to work for us, and, you know, me and you and everybody else are going to stand here and go, oh my God, that's amazing. It's Boba Fett we've always seen. But is that necessarily then going to shortchange us and maybe getting a bigger, better story? And again, I think, like you said already, you got to kind of take a step back and go, we're only midway through the first book. And if rumours are true that this is going to get greenlit for a second series, well, then potentially whatever we do see at the end of this series, I'm sure there will be some kind of conclusion to the current storyline. But I think there's going to be ramifications for a wider, bigger story. And maybe in some respects, you have Boba Fett in this series now focusing on just getting the house in order, so to speak, getting the palace and the locals to kind of respect him or to fear him or whatever he needs to do. You go into season two and suddenly it's like, right, how do we kind of roll this out bigger? How do we get the kind of Jabba the Hutt level of respect and notoriety that Boba Fett maybe wants?
That's another great point, though, because, and again, I think because we've been around the characters a long time, but this is a new presentation of them, and it's a new angle on Jabba in a way. You never really quite knew what Fortuna would do, and you realise he just sat there and got fat. And just
pretty much,
And just coasted on the reputation of what Jabba had done and didn't really expand it himself. Let the gangs get away from him within Mos Espa, and that's on the doorstep. So when I did the review, and it kind of came over as a criticism, and it sort of was, but it's not, because I'm very conscious that there's four more episodes to come and possibly a second season, and it's going to fold into the other Favloniverse stories or whatever you want to call it. But it feels like right now we're dealing with a cleanup on aisle three when there's a tsunami coming.
Yeah.
You know, and there's big stuff on the way. There's like a gang war. It feels like there's a gang war coming, or there's some major problem that's coming Fett's way. And at the moment, like the water seller who's quite curt and quite clear that, you know, well, nobody respects you. You've just kind of rocked up and nobody really knows what you're about. Lothar Peel, the watermonger from the workers' districts, and he's sort of laying it out for Fett, and they're all looking like, can he talk to Fett like this? And Fett's like, no, I kind of need to hear this.
Yeah.
And he does need to hear it. So get your house in order, get your immediate house in order. And it feels like these episodes are getting the house in order locally. Maybe that's what season one's about. Get Tatooine on side.
Exactly.
Make it so that you look at that throne. Jabba's half a decade gone and Fortuna's dead and Bobba's the guy. So you go to Jabba's palace, you ain't going to Jabba's palace, you go to Bobba's palace. You know, we still call it Jabba's palace. He ain't been there for 5 years. Yeah. He's dead. The legacy of Jabba still hangs very heavy over Tatooine, all of Tatooine, not just the cities we've seen in this series. But Fett's got to get past that. And Fett was like one of Jabba's top guys. We know this from the past. We saw it in Return of the Jedi. He was there. He's one of Jabba's guys.
Mm.
The one thing that's weird, and I think it follows through a lot of Star Wars stuff anyway, it was very prevalent in The Last Jedi, to a lesser degree in Force Awakens, but almost that, you know, we're only 30 years past Endor in Force Awakens, for example. And it's like the whole galaxy has forgotten what happened.
Yeah.
You get to this original trilogy and it's almost like everyone forgot that before Order 66 and before the Emperor took over and the Empire began, that there was a galaxy full of Jedi Knights. There was thousands of them living in a temple on Coruscant. It's like the galaxy has got a short-term memory problem.
Yeah.
And everyone seems to have forgotten about Boba Fett. And it's exactly what you said. We've been following Fett since the 90s, or some of us the 80s, and as a character, as this kick-ass, uncompromising, not particularly chatty guy who's not going to sit on a speederboat grinning at Tusken Raiders, which I thought was a brilliant scene last week, by the way. But you know what I'm saying? There's a perception of Fett. Judge Dredd never takes his helmet off. And now here he is doing all these different things. It's blowing some people's minds.
But that's probably down to the fact that a portion of people just assumed that Fett died on the sail barge.
Yes.
Probably word has come out from the survivors, let's say Max Rebo, and he was like, oh yeah, no, I saw Fett like head first into a Sarlacc pit. Yeah, he's done for. He's dead. I mean, and maybe it's a commentary just on society today. You know, we do forget pretty quickly. Some kind of new kind of disaster or to something. Mm. And actually, then the next thing comes along and we all focus on that. And we're like, nobody ever kind of looks at the cumulative effects and go, actually, hang on a sec, what about this? And, you know, that wasn't resolved and all that. And so maybe it's just kind of a commentary on that. I think what we're kind of facing is possibly just the teething difficulties of this series.
Yeah.
Some of the issues that I have with this series is more of a, you know, it's a series thing. It's not necessarily on a episode by episode thing. So it's kind of creative decisions or directions that they've taken, which just doesn't necessarily line up with either my own expectations or maybe my own kind of creative kind of sense of where I would place things. But let's be fair, we've still got a great Boba Fett series. It's a Boba Fett series that's brought Machete into a galaxy far, far away.
That whole sequence was brilliant. Bringing the twins back was great. The interplay, the veiled threats and the sort of tacit agreements that was there and then leaving the Rancor, which is obviously a Trojan horse.
Yeah.
That whole sequence. And like you say, having Danny Trejo in it was brilliant because he's kind of Robert Rodriguez's lucky charm. Second cousins as well, which
exactly.
I didn't realise until I did a bit of research.
Mm.
So, you know, so there's all of that, which was fascinating. And really enjoyed that. And the Black Cassantan scene was phenomenal. That jump when he pulls him out of the Bacta tank was just, whoa, what the heck? You know, and the whole fight sequence. So they're all the positives. And I'm loving the flashback stuff. And I know there's been a lot of kickback on the fact that the Tuskens, that particular tribe of Tuskens, are completely wiped out. Like, we haven't seen that happen before in Star Wars. Anakin wiped out an entire village.
Yeah.
A whole sandcrawler full of Jawas were taken out in A New Hope. We have a relationship to these Tuskens because we've just spent two episodes with them, especially in the tribes of Tatooine. We really got deep into them and learnt more about them and how they are, what they do, and all the real world links to people here on Earth, which was very well put together. There's a wonderful article on Gizmodo by Jordan Mason that looked at that. Well worth seeking out. We put a link on Fantha. So there's all the connections there. But I didn't see an issue with that particular storyline being stopped because everything is about servicing the storyline of Boba Fett.
Yeah.
And that is part of Boba Fett's journey. This isn't a show about the Tusken Raiders. It's not a show about Jabba. It's not a show about Black Cassantan. It's all about Boba Fett and every single character serves the story of Boba Fett. It's the book of Boba Fett. So if that's what happened, that's what happened, because that motivates Boba in his activities and what he does. Look at Fett, how he wants respect. Fett would look at the tribal chief of that Tusken clan and see that he leads by respect. He's respected by everybody with him, beneath him, alongside him. Fett almost aspires to be that guy. When he gets dragged out the Sarlacc pit and he's done and he's dead and the Jawas nick his armor and knock him out and then the Tuskens find him, he's dead. He shouldn't be alive, but he is. And that Tusken, that is the guy Fett wants to be. And so you can see that the role of those Tuskens in the broader story is absolutely pivotal to where this thing's going to go.
Absolutely. Even in A New Hope, if Aunt Beru and Uncle Owen weren't burnt alive by the stormtroopers, Luke would have stayed on Tatooine.
Yeah, agreed. I have no doubt.
It's that key motivator. And the first time I saw it, I didn't quite understand the relation in the Vision Quest, but I think the fact that we've gone back into the Bacta tank and we've gone back to that flashback of him as young Daniel Logan era Boba, and he's watching Slave One go, I think it's all about abandonment. And I think, again, you know, in a similar kind of way, maybe what Rodriguez and Jon Favreau are kind of saying is that actually that Tatooine tribe gave Boba that kind of family that he's never really had. And probably if they hadn't have got wiped out, he would have probably been quite happy to stay there, maybe for the rest of his, you know, for rest of his days, or at least for like a long period of time. So this is like that kick up the arse, isn't it, to move the story along. And again, I think also then, like I said in the previous episode, where the events of the past are going to kind of merge with events of the present, this is what we're seeing. The Pikes now being an issue in the past and in the present. Admittedly, and it might be because I've read a lot of War of the Bounty Hunters recently, I was really expecting the big threat wasn't going to be the Pikes, but it was going to be Crimson Dawn. I'm not at all disappointed about whatsoever, and that might still be something that comes to pass in season two or whatever. But I thought it was a really interesting choice to kind of make them that secondary threat. And actually the Hutts maybe would be too much of an obvious choice to make them the current threat for Jabba's title and everything. But the Pikes, is that something a little bit different and makes it a little bit more interesting?
Pikes we've seen in Solo, but we've seen them in the Clone Wars. They've been around a bit, that, like you say, War of the Bounty Hunters and presumably Crimson Reign going forward. To bring Crimson Dawn into it, especially since War of the Bounty Hunters did such a good job of bringing Crimson Dawn and Kira back and really making them a very big threat, like out of the blue, back from the dead. like Boba Fett. They've been around all that time, but like Palpatine, yeah. So many characters kind of come back. I think with the Hutts, Tatooine, it is like an ancillary Hutt world almost, isn't it? Because Jabba was there and he was the prime Hutt. Hutt space is enormous compared to most of the regions of the galaxy. Owned regions, if you like corporate sectors, a big area. Hutt space is ginormous. So they're obviously prominent in the underworld, and War of the Bounty Hunters did a great job of showing that at the auction, the solo auction, the Pikes are there and Jabba's there and the Empire's there and all these factions. You think the Empire is going to sit above everything. It doesn't work like that. I think that's another thing that in a broader galactic scale, slightly getting away from this, that Palpatine still, mostly through his envoys and his underlings, but there was still a lot of politics to be done, you know, to hold the galaxy in place, to do deals and work alongside, not necessarily with, but sort of alongside other organizations that had hold in different areas of the galaxy. It was really important, and Jabba was part of that, but not the top of the tree. And I think you go back to Shadows of the Empire when Shizor turns up and speaks to Jabba, and Jabba starts talking in Huttese, and Shizor says, "Speak basic," and all of a sudden Jabba's just speaking in basic. I remember at the time I was like, shocked. What? There's an underworld guy that's telling Jabba what to do? What? And that feeds to this. Jabba's obviously a huge operator, but as kids, you're thinking Jabba's the king of the underworld. Jabba's Don Corleone is the godfather of all this. And he wasn't. He was part of a massive network, prominent part, but not the top guy. It goes back to what you just said about Fett. Most people, like you say, would think he was dead. But to me, I'm thinking you'd still know the name Boba Fett. It's almost like he's walking around going, "I am Boba Fett." And they're going, "Who?" And it's 5 years on. If we're living in regular society and there's a gangster lives up the road, why would I know his name? I have nothing to do with that world. In Star Wars, there's people just, "I'm a moisture farmer, I run a bar, I'm a taxi driver," whatever. Why would they know about all that stuff just because they live in the Star Wars galaxy? It doesn't necessarily track that they would, so it does make sense.
For everything in one location, daily news, reviews, interviews, podcasts, video and social media feeds, bookmark FanthaTracks.com for Star Wars news 24/7, 365.
I think it's fair to say that the most divisive part of this episode is the mods, just the mods in their aesthetic style, but also that speeder chase. What's your thoughts? Is it a little bit too on the nose?
Visually, I've got no problem with it, because if they were riding over 1313 on Coruscant, you wouldn't bat an eyelid. If you saw them in Attack of the Clones, you go, cool. If they were parked outside Dex's diner when Dexter are having that chat, you wouldn't think a thing about them. I've got to say, all having the English accents, that sort of North London English accent, all right, mate, that sort of thing, not mad keen on that, because it's too now, that didn't work. And all the wing mirrors on one of the speeders, that's straight out of Quadrophenia. That was way too on the nose. Yeah. So why would they have wing mirrors?
The issue was that it was far too a literal depiction, whereas I think maybe if you were to go down a slightly more pronounced and lengthy development period, you know, so we want a Vespa mod style, but let's do some different iterations. You know, like when you go into the art of Star Wars books and you see like 4 or 5 or maybe 10 different variations, and you kind of start off with a square boxy droid, and then through 15 iterations you end up with BB-8.
Yes.
I think that's kind of what's missing. And if you go back and if you look at the Mandalorian art of season 1 book, it was very much Favreau and Filoni said, "This is what we want." The concept artist drew it, and there was maybe a couple of changes, but because of the way that they described it and they were so precise, that was the end of the development period. That's how at least that book reads anyway. And I think that's what's possibly happened here. Maybe it feels more on the nose because we are in Britain and it felt a little bit too stereotypical. I also do agree with what Paul Bateman was saying the other day on Twitter. I think there's far too many zips in these costumes. I know that Pablo came out and gave him shtick and showed him a gif of Luke zipping up his flight suit, but that zip is hidden. You don't see that zip. That zip doesn't exist. It's just a way of getting in. And I think, a bit like with the biker gangs from the previous episode, there was a Kington Striders. Again, they're just like, okay, we want a biker gang, put them in denim and leather, put some patches on them. And it's just like, well, just because you put a Nikto head on them doesn't make them Star Wars. And I think that is my main issue with this series so far. That on top, I could get away with a brighter colour Vespers, but they're just too bloody clean. And I think that's an issue with this whole series so far. Everything just feels too clean. It's Tatooine and it's dusty as anything. Even at the end of that chase, when the Majordomo's buried in the melee runs, he's not that dusty. And you think, well, that would have kicked up a load of sand and a load of dust. There's just not enough weathering. It doesn't feel used enough like Star Wars is meant to be.
I saw Paul's comment about the zips, and I do agree that was a thing that Macquarie and John Wallow especially, yep, and Lucas initially, and I know the real world gets in the way, and there are zips in Star Wars and buttons and stuff. We saw it in Rogue One, yeah, and so on and so forth. But it was always the thing that was the goal, was to try not to show zips and clasps. Like in season two of, this was the first one that really stood out. Season two of The Mandalorian, the frog lady meets her partner. Mm. You see the Mon Calamari in the knitted sweater.
Yeah,
And somebody within minutes found that exact knitted sweater on Amazon. It's like, No, there's got to be more put into it than that. If you can literally buy these clothes off the shelf, blimey, how easy would it be to join the Rebel Legion if you could buy everything from the Gap?
Oh, God, I mean, this is it. I mean, you kind of expect that to a degree when you're looking at James Bond's costumes. You know, you go to Enfield, and yes, you do, you spend 350 quid on like a knitted jumper or stuff, but it's that sartorial kind of nature, and there's kind of a lifestyle to that, and obviously it's real world. It's not Galaxy Far, Far Away or a Gap store outlet, you know, far away. So I completely get your point.
This is Matt Fox. May the toys be with you. You are listening to Fantatrax.
The one thing these new shows are missing are the visual dictionaries. There was supposed to be a visual dictionary for Mandalorian. It got postponed or cancelled. I think Pablo worked on it, as you just mentioned, Pablo. That's the place where, for example, with these bikes, which I thought, again, if these are on Coruscant, no problem. And if they can be on Coruscant, they can be anywhere in the Star Wars galaxy.
That's the point of mods, isn't it? Because that's the whole thing. Because if you go back to the mod movement, you know, in the 60s, they were watching French and Italian films in a reading Italian magazine. Where they got their clothing kind of identity was from different cultures and stuff like that. Yeah. And so kind of like, as much as it's meant to be out of place on Tatooine, but you're right. If you stuck them in the middle of Coruscant or like in the Outlander Club on Attack of the Clones, they would just walk past and you probably wouldn't even bat an eyelid. But I think that juxtaposition kind of works. It's just kind of like maybe the execution of that juxtaposition. The costumes, for me, barring the young lady,
Sophie Thatcher.
Apart from her costume, the rest of them, this is Star Wars, but she was the one who was like, you know, that's a little bit too... And then you've got the Vespers or the Speeders, or whatever you want to call them. But you're right, you get a visual dictionary, you get that kind of explained, like it or lump it, you kind of go, okay, fair enough, that kind of makes sense. You know, and then you move on. Because we don't kind of get that stuff now, we're left to pick at it and itch at it and stuff. I mean, one other note I will say about those Vespers, they look even more tacky when you watch it in HDR, because the colours are so more vibrant. When you watch it in standard dynamic range, actually, like I did this morning, I was like, they're not so bad. But in the HDR, it's like, wow, really stick out, and not in a nice way either.
Should always be able to criticise things that we don't like, and should always be able to pick fun at it, so that, you know, we're not that pious that we can't have a bit of fun with it. And there was a video on YouTube that basically did that chase with the Power Rangers music. It was very well done. Fair comment. I mean, those primary colours really do stand out, and I like the bikes. And what it was saying about the visual dictionary was that was the place where Pablo or whoever would go, well, the reason the sand didn't stick to those bikes was they had an electrostatic a Towersy filter on the back that would bounce the sand off it, and they'd explain why. I'm picking silly names, you know what I mean, though. You know, there'd be something that meant that it didn't, you know, and they'd come up with some reason
to
retcon and explain, and that's a big part of the fun of these kind of books. But we haven't got that because this is a weekly show and it's going
by. There's not enough time.
So, exactly. But what did you think of their situation? Because on one hand, they're like, oh, we can't afford water. The water's too expensive. And there was that little exchange with Fett and the watermonger.
Again, I think it's kind of like a mod culture. A lot of them were kind of working class. They would have fairly dull jobs. And, well, even now, without kind of being too on the nose, you know, how often do you see people who may be on Universal Credit with like a brand spanking new iPhone 13?
That's it. They can't afford water, but they can afford brand new bikes. That's just kids, isn't it? And they're obviously sort of early 20s is the kind of vibe they're going for. It just feels like they're building Fett's team, loosely using that term team, and I expect Black Cassantan to come into that team at some point. I just do.
Yes, it makes perfect sense.
Doesn't it? You know, he's a mercenary as well, so if he's paid well, he'll do it. Like the scene with all the food at the table and Fett's like, ugh, not hungry. You know, oh, enjoy your spoils, that sort of thing. There's obviously money there that cost doesn't feel like it's particularly a massive issue at the moment.
Well, no, because, he tells Danny Trejo's character to go and get a whole Ronto corpse out of the cellar to feed Rancor. Now, that can't be cheap because the Rontos are pretty massive.
And I want to see that as well. I really do want to see a Ronto in this series. Yeah. I'm kind of surprised the amount that we saw in the special edition walking down the street that we haven't seen one walking around Mos Espa at the moment. It's just something we haven't seen. I hope we do. Mm. In its isolation, there's valid grumbles.
Yes.
But on the broader scale, I think there isn't. Because aesthetically, I mean, we're purely talking aesthetics when we talk about this biker gang or swoop gang or whatever you want to call them. I don't think they would just drop them, because it really is like dropping the Green Power Ranger into an episode of Star Wars, isn't it? There's a reason that they're there that will become apparent later on. And I think generally Marvel have done it brilliantly with certain things, and everyone's so quick to judge.
Oh, God.
Everyone's so quick to bite. Twitter was just ablaze on Wednesday night of people moaning about it. But I think when you get to episode 4, chapter 4, and move on, you'll suddenly go, ah, that's why they were there. They were from Coruscant, or they were from wherever. It could be anything. It really, literally right now, it could be anything.
There's a certain fire spray in it, for all we know, because we've not seen that other than in flashbacks yet. We haven't seen the Slave 1.
That's true. No, we haven't.
I think that whole chase scene, from the moment they get into the mayor's office, it kind of goes a little astray, because Fett and Fennec let the Majordomo walk into the mayor's office. We just saw them in the previous episode. They pretty much just forced their way in. So then suddenly Fett's now kind of like, okay, I'm going to sit, stand back and wait, which maybe shows a development in his kind of character and maybe the relationship between him and the mayor. But then obviously all it does is it gives the Majordomo a chance to kind of like hightail it out of there into a very Back to the Future 2 kind of chase scene.
And so many conversations about that, a lot of negative, a lot valid. Some people made the point that they think that it was a bit slow because they wanted to show off the environment. And if it was too quick, you wouldn't see the environment. To which I would say, well, if that was the case, you would just pull back a little bit, because it's fairly tight on the chase, so you can see the characters' faces. If you wanted to convey the speed, you'd just pull back a little bit like you did in the pod race. Not that they're going to be going that speed, but, you know, you'd pull it back and you'd show a wider view looking down on Mos Espa, and you'd see a bit more. And I'm still hoping to see locations that we remember from Phantom Menace and Attack of the Clones. We haven't quite seen that yet, but to sort of tie the two things together. But nevertheless, I think if that's what they wanted to do, they would pull back, but they didn't. The best analogy is what you've just said. It's that Back to the Future 2, 1 and 2 chase very much felt like it was in that ballpark. That was the thing they wanted to make you think of. Star Wars doesn't need to refer to other things like that. It just doesn't. I know it's cute and funny and nods to this and nods to that. If you want to make a cute nod to something, tweet it. You don't need to put it into Star Wars. Star Wars can refer to itself now. Star Wars is big enough. It doesn't need to refer to anything else other than Star Wars. We've got such a rich literature, comic book, visual in many different realms, and of course, television and film history of Star Wars. If you want to refer to something from an episode of Droids. People will get it. You don't need to refer to something from Back to, because it's clearly what they were pointing you towards with this chase. And the Mailer on Fruit was cool, because, you know.
Yeah, Rebels. See, that is a reference, which is kind of quite nice, because you kind of go, oh, yeah, exactly. Rebels from that. It did remind me of, you know, not only the Back to the Future chase, but obviously I think there's a certain level of poking fun at all those kind of chases, you know, where you get the guys walking back and forward. I can't remember what show it was in, or there's two guys whose only job is to walk backwards and forwards with a plane of glass, just so Wayne's World or something like that? I can't remember.
It's Naked Gun, I think it's one of those.
It's satirical in its nature anyway, but yeah, so you know, that was kind of fun. Wasn't 100% sure about the fact there was that Ralph McQuarrie kind of art concept art that would just drive through. I was like, wow, that's kind of like as much on the nose as you're going to get, even if you didn't realise it was Ralph McQuarrie art. It just didn't quite match anyway. Anyhow, the second and third time I watched it, I was like, I'm less offended by it now than I was the first time. I was like, this is a bit janky. There were some shots and some of the VFX just wasn't quite up to scratch. It was like the speeders were lacking a bit of motion blur to make it look like that they were actually moving. Again, we assume that this whole series has probably got like a budget of like about 100 million. So this is going to mean that you take away the developmental time, it's going to be probably less than what, $10 million per episode or something like that. So, you know, you've got to put that into perspective, and you can't kind of necessarily hold it up against like a Star Wars film that costs like $200+ million for the film. So there is a part of that as well. It was okay. It's not going to make my top bit of 2022 when it comes to Star Wars, but, you know, we're still only January and we're still only halfway through the series, so we've still got a lot of Star Wars left to view. Right, well, I think for today, that's all we've got time for. So, Marky Boy, can you let the good listeners know how they can get in touch if they've got, like, a comment or question or a theory or, as usual, a complaint?
We are the complaints department, of course.
Of course.
If you want to be a part of the action and stay updated on all the latest Star Wars news, visit FanthaTracks.com or check out the FanthaTracks app through the App Store to follow us on your mobile device. You can reach out to us and send in your listeners' questions by emailing radio@fanthatracks.com. Like Mark just said, we need new questions. We've got loads of time now because we're doing our standalone episode reviews on a Wednesday night, so we'll have more time in our Tuesday episodes to go through listeners' questions. We've got Jay Manchand, the artist, interview with him coming in the next episode as well. So please send your questions in. We will be talking about anything and everything. Comment, like and share on all of our social media feeds at FantaTrax, and be sure to subscribe, leave a review, preferably a 5-star one, on Amazon Music, Audible, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, or your podcatcher or smart speaker of choice. And as always, thanks to James Semple for composing the FantaTrax intro, Adam O'Brien for our Making Tracks opening music, and Mark Daniel and Vanessa Marshall for our voiceovers. Remember, tune into our FantaTrax new show, Good Morning Tatooine. It's live most Sunday evenings, not on at the moment. It will be back soon. We're having a little break whilst we rejig a few things. It will be back, but when it is, it's 9 p.m. UK time, 4 p.m. Eastern, 1 p.m. Pacific on Facebook and YouTube. And that's me done for this episode.
Have a good week, and no doubt I will catch up with you. Well, I'll catch up with you on Wednesday anyway, if nothing else.
Yes.
Yes. For everybody else, thank you very much for listening. Do appreciate it. Take care. Stay safe. Remember, wear those masks, get jabbed, get boosted, and may the Force be with you.
Coming up next on FantaTrax Radio, it's another episode of Making Tracks.